With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Sister Bliss is a multi-award winning DJ, composer, record label owner, broadcaster and founder member of dance pioneers Faithless alongside Maxi Jazz and Rollo. She's been at the forefront of the scene since 1993 and has sold over 15 million records internationally and produced chart hits like God is a DJ and Insomnia. Sister Bliss has collaborated with Dido, Boy George, and Example to name but a few, and has written music for film, TV, and theatre. After almost 30 years in the business, she continues to release music, headline festivals, present her own New York Festival bronze medal radio show, and is currently bringing the country together to social distance. Sister Bliss, welcome and thank you for joining me. We are currently in a quarantine situation still. How have you found everything? How have you been? And have you managed to be creative and still keep that going over this time?
Well, it has been a really mad time. I'm a single parent to a 13-year-old, so I have been homeschooling. So I have to say it hasn't left me in the most sort of creative headspace, because you're holding a psychic space for a kid who's not getting to see any of his friends. Things are opening up gently now, but it's been quite an intense time, but I'm a great believer in routine, saving one's mental health and physical. And I've done loads of online kind of, you know, Joe Wicks PE, and we have a real routine in the day. And now my son says he doesn't want to go back to school. He just wants to stay at home with me. I'm like, no, I've got to get in the studio. So I have woven in bits of creativity. But for me, by the time the kind of what we're calling the school day ends, My creative juices are kind of fried, really, and I'm pretty much only good for a box set and making our tea as well. So, yeah. No, but having said that, we're in the process of just about to release new Faithless material. So there has been a mad scramble to get everything finished and ready for that. So that is actually very exciting. But that's more like finishing off bits of music and checking through remixes and trying to deliver videos and artwork and all the things that go along. People think making music's just sitting in a studio making the music, but there's just so much more that goes along with that. So it's been those, the last couple of weeks has been, if you like, a production couple of weeks, really. But I'd love to just be in the headspace to write some new music. And I've got a studio at home, so I'm very, very lucky. But I also have a studio outside of home and I'm really missing going there. So that's what I aim to do. You know, as soon as I can have some childcare for my son, I'll get out and be out in King's Cross, having it in my studio where there is no distractions, no lunch to make for anybody, no having to bully him into doing homework and all of that sort of stuff, which definitely takes a lot of energy. I'm not complaining. I'm really blessed. I did say to him yesterday, there is no one I would have rather spent lockdown with, because he is really funny and silly and joyous to be around. Well, if lockdown's brought us anything, it's just to make sure our communities are tight and we're looking out for our friends and family as best we can. And so I guess for me, my music's taken a little bit of a backseat in terms of just being in the studio every day and that filling my mental, you know, creative spaces.
Yeah, I've definitely found a whole new sense of gratitude in this time, generally because of how lucky I've been and everyone I know has been completely healthy, and I've surrounded myself with my family. And I think it's been a really strange time to create music in, but what I've really enjoyed about it is how free and open you can be in this time, really. I've really found to be actually less boundaried with my creativity and actually just kind of figured out what do I want to write, which is quite a nice thing to be able to do. And is really a question I'd like to ask you before we start delving into the history of your career path and the rest of that. How have you found this album, this new album that you're about to release?
It's amazing that you just said what you said, because it kind of hits the nail on the head. It does feel like a record of gratitude, not just gratitude that people are still interested after 25 years, but gratitude for the blessings we have in our life, and to try and look towards them rather than towards the negative, and focusing on what we don't have. And sometimes what we think we don't have is absolutely unimportant anyway, you know. And I feel like the record was made in that creative space before all of this came to pass. But it feels, I mean, I really hope that it will be really relevant. It does have a kind of spiritual center to it, if you like, as I guess all faithless music has done thus far.
Have you, is this album through a label, or are you guys doing it yourself? How is it running?
It's coming out on BMG Records, which is a major record label. Mm-hmm. We have self-released before. We've been on a tiny record label and other major record labels over the years. So it's been really, enriching experience to understand all the processes that go along with being a signed artist. But we were approached by BMG after we released, or even maybe just before the last record we made, and we were very excited to work with them. We've got a real legend at the helm, a guy called Corder Marshall, who signed some amazing artists over the years, and there's a lot of trust there as well. It feels like, because we've had a long career, they trust us to get on with it. They're not interfering, you know. They're allowing us to use the mechanics that they can bring to the table and their expertise, and we're working together with them, which I think is very different if you're a new artist and you need a lot of guidance. And mm-hmm. you know, we got a fairly good idea of, you know, how to make it work. But you know, first and foremost, the music's got to be right. It's got to feel right. It's got to be the best that we can make it, and that's taken some time. There's been a lot of craft that's gone into this record, but I hope it feels really fresh as well.
How long did it take you?
And it is dancing. Well, we've just been working on it, I would say, for the last few years, like 3 years on and off.
Wow.
Like, there's been other projects in between and lots of bits and pieces, but it's taken that long to kind of come together and actually get to the finishing line and decide when to release it. So we could have released it a year ago probably, but events conspired to make us feel actually no, we wanted to carry on working on it. So we've had the luxury of a nice long lead up, but as ever, it seems like an absolute mad scramble now. You know, release dates are in a concrete plan, you know, and everybody's galvanized. But I guess that's the exciting bit of putting music into the world. It is a strange time now. You sometimes think, God, you know, music's so fluffy, and then you forget actually music feels like salvation. It keeps you company in hard times, makes you feel less alone. You know, Faithless is a band that's always been concerned with lyrical content.
Yeah.
And I feel, you know, over the years, people have told us personally how much they've got from our records, not just a sort of sense of exuberance and losing it on the dance floor, but much, much more than that. It's become a real, you know,
spiritual moment.
Yeah, you know, and you, I have to remember that when I think people are struggling for the basics. Well, actually, for a lot of people, music really is food for the soul.
And massively, yeah.
I hope this record delivers that, you know, in a funky way. It's definitely got a summer vibe to it, though. I would say there's some dark corners on the record, but the record we're coming with next is really exuberant and joyful.
How do you find releasing music in 2020 compared to releasing music 20 years ago?
Well, for us, this is our first album that's going into the world of streaming, like fully into the world of streaming. So it's a whole brave new world. I guess that's the main difference. Also, the whole of our industry has been turned on its head, and there are no gigs. My whole summer of festivals and all the shows I have booked have all completely been cancelled or postponed. And that's a real shocking reality, and a lot of people in our industry are suffering. My tour managers, my crew, the lighting people, the roadies, the riggers, you know, the drivers. I mean, all our technicians have no work. All the people that work at festivals year in, year out, and spend years, you know, months and months building up the lineup. So we're also releasing it into a world where there is no promotion, particularly beyond streaming and YouTube, I guess, and talking to the likes of you, which is a great privilege.
Likewise.
So it does seem very odd to put a record out, I guess, without the traditional mechanics of touring behind it and live performance, which obviously has been a central tenet of our musical world for 20 odd years. You know, we've been in a band and we've been on tour, DJing festivals. That's my livelihood. It's my life. It's an essential and joyous part of musical expression. All I can say is I'm glad I'm not just starting out. At least I can look back and say, well, I have done all of those things. So letting go of one summer of chaos is much, I'd say a little easier for me than it is for a huge number of artists, you know, that don't have a back catalogue, that have never put a record out or just completely reliant on streaming. I mean, I write music for TV and film as well. I do all sorts of other projects, but even those aren't being made at the moment. So, you know,
Of course.
It really changes, what can I say, the platforms that your music can get exposed have been severely reduced. But let's hope it's temporary. Temporary. We've got to keep hoping that, you know, the world of theatre, dance, music, filming, live shows, club shows, all of that will find a safe way to do it in the really not too distant future, because our whole arts culture in this country and I think across Europe is in peril.
Well, I was about to say, there's something about somebody listening to a song, but there's something about somebody really connecting with a song live. And there's been many times when I've been like, I listened to this on the album and I didn't really feel it, but now I'm here, I get it. So are you nervous? Because I definitely am nervous about releasing music in when we can't go out and promote it ourselves, really. Are you? How do you feel about it?
I'd just say I have to let go of it. It is what it is and we have to work within what it is. As I say, I'm incredibly lucky that I've got a 30-year back catalogue. People can revisit and connect with their memories of seeing us live and imagine what it could be. Which is why there's been such a lot of work to make sure the records, but as there always is, truly, truly deliver. But yes, there is nothing like connecting the song with the artist and having that communal experience, you know, that we've written about loads of times in records like God is a DJ or We Come One. You know, absolutely tapping into that collective consciousness. It's the most sort of profound, humbling, exhilarating, mind-blowing experience you can have as an artist and as a punter.
Yeah.
You know, what a buzz. I don't know how that can be replicated, but we have to work within the parameters we've got. And as I say, we're lucky because we're not a new artist launching. There are people who seem to be interested in hearing a new Faithless record, and thank the Lord for that. And I'm sure for you as well, Becky, you've spent a few years building up a really incredible audience, and you have a real foothold in the world of streaming. Whereas our world was actually in the world of physical product. People literally would buy CDs and vinyl. So this is, as I say, brave new world for us, but we have faith that the label are supporting us, so we're not out on our own and we're not a new band launching. As I say, that would be it would feel particularly perilous if everything is riding on that moment and you can't even go out there and sing your songs.
No.
You know, in a festival setting, which is where you get the most generous crowds and you get you know, all different kinds of genres of music sitting together, and that's the beauty. I would say that is absolutely key in how, you know, our career has lasted this long, is because we performed to audiences that weren't expecting to like us, and then they went away sort of like, oh wow, didn't know Faithless was like this, I didn't even like dance music before, you know. And I love that. I love kind of, you know,
surprising people,
changing their expectations. There was definitely a feeling. We always used to talk about it. It's like when we go out on stage, it's like we are going out to fight a battle. You sort of imagine that everybody hates you. I mean, we did a massive heavy metal festival in Finland in the early days, and as we walked on they said, Faithless suck, you guys suck. And the band before had like bitten a head off a pigeon, kind of Ozzy Osbourne style. And the lead singer was covered in blood. And we're like, why have we been booked to play this festival? But we just kind of turned up the punk energy, which is what you can do in a live performance. The record is as it's recorded. But like, you know, the energy of performing to an audience, you can bring out parts of yourself as a performer that don't necessarily translate on record. So we literally, our sound engineer cranked up the drums and the guitars, and Maxi put on his biggest anarcho-Buddhist punk vibes, and we won the respect of that crowd. And that's a very satisfying kind of show to do. And I think we've done that because we've played at many, many festivals that weren't dance music festivals. They were really for rock bands, and dance music was seen as a bit of a poor cousin. Like, this is just kind of fluffy, you know, not very deep music. And I feel proud of hopefully the work we did for our whole electronic music community to show people that you can rock a main stage, even if it's two turntables and a microphone, or an eight-piece band as we are, you know, or a superstar DJ. And it can give as much pleasure as, you know, Limp Bizkit or, you know, Lenny Kravitz or REM, just naming Metallica. These are a few of the people that we've shared the stage with over the years.
Well, it really shows how cultural and what a movement Faithless has been, not just for the 90s, but that has transcended through. So on that, I want to know, I think what I'd like to start with your talents on instruments. When did you start learning piano? Because you can play bass guitar, piano, violin and the saxophone. Am I correct in saying that?
I can. But I mean, having said that, I haven't picked them up for like, well, I play keyboards all the time, but I haven't picked up the other instruments for probably a good 15 odd years. But yeah, I wanted to be Prince, basically. I think we probably all do.
Oh, thank you.
We just want to do everything. And I would teach myself instruments.
It was never a thing that your parents kind of...
No, I was very lucky because my dad was a jazz musician. He still plays, actually. He plays saxophone and piano. So those instruments were in my house. So I begged to learn the piano, and I learned since I was 5 years old. I begged and nagged and nagged and nagged and nagged until they got me piano lessons. And then I had a friend who played the violin, so I wanted to do what she did. So then I picked that up when I was about eight. And then I taught myself the flute and then started having lessons.
Wow.
And then my dad was in a band with a bloke called Frank, and Frank left his bass around our house. So I just picked it up and taught myself bass. I was in a band playing bass really badly. You know, please don't think there was anything kind of virtuoso about any of it. But it enabled me to make house music. So I'm very thankful. And I kind of hear instrumentation in my head, which is kind of how I write. But now all instruments come through keyboard for me. And if we need guitar or we work with other musicians on our records, we get them in. We don't rely on me doing things really badly. You know, we have paid string sections to do beautiful orchestral passages on some of our albums. It wouldn't be me scraping away. I don't even know if my violin works anymore. It was under my mum's bed for, well, probably about another 15 years gathering dust.
Is it your violin playing on Salva Mia?
No, I think that was a keyboard. We did it on a keyboard, played everything on a keyboard.
It's just the lies that we tell on Logic, right?
I know, but you know, when they keep giving us these amazing string sections from orchestras, it's amazing. And it's very cost effective as well. Let's be honest, it's not cheap hiring.
I was about to say that, yeah. So when did you first fall in love with dance music?
When I first heard it, I'd always loved synthesizers. I'd always loved, which is probably going to lead us to one of the tunes that I've picked as my special meaningful records today.
trying to be professional.
You're leading me right there. Yeah, right through the 80s, I loved all of synth pop. Anything that had synthesizers in it, I was absolutely fascinated with, because it just sounded like another world. Mm. And when I first started going out clubbing, it was like to 50s and 60s nights at Camden Palace. And then I discovered with a friend of mine his gay bar in King's Cross, which weirdly enough is also mentioned in Bernardine Evaristo's amazing book, Girl, Woman, Other. If you haven't read it, you must. And it's a place called The Bell. It's now become the Big Chill Bar. just on Pentonville Road.
Yes, I know.
And it used to have the most rocking nights there. And they'd play everything like Madonna, Prince, 12 Inches, Iggy Pop. And then you'd hear this record that sounded like it came from Mars. And it was very early house music. So that was like 1987, 88. I just couldn't get enough of it. And then I discovered pirate radio and underground mad warehouse parties, basically. And it really wasn't at all mainstream, this music. You could not hear it anywhere. It was so buried. And that was it. I was just smitten with all of it. And then a couple of years after that, I met a guy in a Camden Market, and he sold me my first Atari and a crack copy of a computer program called Cubase. And I taught myself how to make a tune on Atari, a little cassette and a little synthesizer. My dad had synthesizers in the house from when I was a kid because he used to use them to play his jazz on. And that was it. I started making demos, just sat there making dance music on my own. And then I met a guy in a record shop because I was also DJing at the time. And he said, my friend's a producer. Why don't we make a tune together? So we went to watch Blade Runner. And very inspired, and we wrote a little tune in my mum's bedroom. And that friend, that mutual friend, was Rollo, and he ended up producing our very first record. And that was in, 91, 92. That was about then. So that was a very, very compressed version of the history. And the very same friend also introduced us to Maxi. A couple of years later, he said, oh, I've met a Buddhist rapper, because he was going out with a girl from Brixton, and this girl was a friend of Maxie's. So Ben brought this guy to our studio, introduced us, and we just got talking about his philosophy and his agenda and his lyrics, and we made Salva Meir together. And that was the first ever Faithless record we made, because it had a bit that we found a button on the Atari that slowed down to a hip-hop beat, and we're like, we've done this house record and we want it to slow down in the middle, but we needed like a rap to go over it. And Rollo asked Maxi, after we talked for ages about what Buddhism meant and, you know, what his religion meant to him, his faith, and he decided to call the project Faithless, and he asked Maxi to write lyrics about feeling so frustrated in his own skin that he couldn't bear to live, really, which is quite sort of dark as a subject matter in dance music. And Maxi absolutely rose to the occasion, and he spoke about not having any faith in himself, and just below my skin I'm screaming was the kind of hook, if you like, for Salva Meir. And it was a very, very uncompromising record, and you probably couldn't dance to it, but we were very proud of it. So that was the very beginning.
That's fascinating. Do you feel like there's a level of darkness that you could have got away with back then over dance music that you can't necessarily get away with now? I always feel like there's a pressure to, especially writing dance music, although I definitely write on more of the commercial side, but that there is a pressure to be happy on the dance floor. And I definitely try and write sad songs on the dance floor, but never necessarily of any kind of weight or heaviness. And I found that growing up, I found that there was a darkness that was incorporated in the 90s dance music that isn't necessarily something that you can get to now.
I think it all depends on the artist and what they want to say. I think the great thing about dance music, it's very forgiving as a genre, and it seems to be incredibly inclusive, from sort of, you know, very uplifting sort of Brazilian house to very minimal to really banging aggressive techno to dubstep to drum and bass. You know, within dance music, it's such a widespread of genres. I think there's always been a space for a message. You know, if you think it was kind of born of black, gay, Hispanic, you know, outcast communities trying to find somewhere to come together, you know, where they weren't persecuted. And a lot of those early house records are very uplifting, but there is a melancholy that runs through them because they're about survival as well. So I always feel, for me, there is this sort of deep emotional core in dance music. Not everybody's explicit with it, but one of the records I've chosen again today, for me, is one of the records that gave us permission, if you like, to visit that darker territory. That, you know, the human experience isn't just about escapism and joy and mindless hedonism. There is a, you know,
connectivity, a deeper meaning about it, right?
Yeah, but there's also deeper meaning, and we can look in the dark corners as well, especially if you've got someone who is such a kind of sensitive narrator and poet like Maxie at the helm. I think he did it in a way that wasn't cliched, but that was very relatable. But also, we had context, and the context was not just the dance floor and the clubs. It was the fact that we were making an album. So it changes how you're listening to music, and perhaps you can, if you like, get away with having a deeper, darker message if you have a whole album to ingest and you know, carries you, as they say, musical cliche, on a journey, which I do believe we do want to do with our records. But we create a space where we can explore all the sort of corners of the human psyche, whether very joyous, uplifting, euphoric, but or with a melancholy undercurrent, or about relationships falling apart. That's the great thing about an album. You can go to all of those places, you know, yeah. Heartbreak, pain, joy, on a kind of 50-minute trip. So I think we were very blessed knowing that we didn't just want to do one track. We wanted to make an album.
So which track of yours was inspiring around that time that you mentioned then?
In terms of music feeling like it could be a revolution, like a call to revolution, and maybe angry and looking at the dark side, Left Fields Open Up. It's an amazing record because they enlisted John Lydon from the Sex Pistols as a vocalist. And you think, what an unlikely pairing, a kind of, you know, British techno slash house band who had a really eclectic vibe as well, bringing in this punk icon. And I'd say it's probably one of the best vocals he's ever done. And it still stands up today. It's an amazing record. It's like
sounds
a call to
fresh.
Arms. And it is angry. And it was exciting. And when you heard that drop on the dance floor, you were like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But you've also got to remember that Left Field made Leftism, which I would say without that album, there wouldn't be a Faithless. That, if you like, allowed us to believe that dance music could live on an album format and be, you know, really valid, mm-hmm. and really enjoyable in a way that maybe just the dance compilation wasn't, because there's definitely a trend for in that period that people have recognised people want a compilation, like a mixtape of all their favourite tunes. And Left Field did a whole album that went all over the place musically, yet still sounded like one thing. So that was a powerful template, I'd say, whether, you know, subconsciously and maybe consciously as well.
Well, let's hear it. This is Left Field, Open Up. Makes you feel like you're on drugs if you're not already. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those kind of hands in the air, bumping into your sweaty friends kind of vibes.
I mean, I think that particular track for me also feels really anti-corporate, anti-big shiny clubs. It feels rough and ready and kind of illegal. And I do know in the last couple of weeks there's been all these mad illegal raves going off.
I've written this down to talk to you about is illegal raves and new music and stuff like that. So with that kind of trend that was happening in the 90s, did you feel like it was kind of opened up for Faithless to do? Because you mentioned earlier, without that album of Left Field, that maybe Faithless wasn't able to find such a clear path. Did you feel that there was any pressure to follow trends, or did you feel like you were starting a trend yourself when back in like 92?
No, it was all kind of accidental, as these things are. It really was meeting Maxie, being fascinated by his philosophy, being able to have a conversation on a particular level, loving the sound of his voice, and feeling that dance music could have an agenda, and not just be, you know, kind of fluffy and mindless, really. But I don't think we knew that we were starting anything. I think we felt outside of... I mean, that there was a particular time when the majority of records were big piano bangers. And it did become a bit tiresome. It felt like House was kind of stuck in a very repetitive loop. I mean, it is a repetitive loop.
I know that
loop.
Feeling.
But that's the deep pleasure of it as well. I love a repetitive loop. Don't get me wrong.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
But it became a little bit stale, and I guess certain records are game changers. There are certain records, you know, like Double 99 kind of invented Speed Garage. That, I think that was Tim Deluxe back in the day. You know, Chemical Brothers, or, you know, even Prodigy. Just certain records changed the scene in a particular way. So I'm not sure that we, you know, I think there was a path that was trodden in a small way before, but I do think we were making records that were outside the mainstream. Apart from anything, they're all 8 minutes long, you know.
Yeah.
We were told when we made Insomnia that we didn't have a hit record. It had no hook, it had no chorus, you know, go away. But Radio 1 also had completely different personnel back then. A year later, they got rid of all the old guard, brought in the new team, understood that actually dance music was a massive cultural force, and this is what young people were listening to and dancing to and spending their every waking moment in love with, just like hip hop was a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know?
What a beautiful moment, especially doing what you guys were doing at the time. It must have been such a validating thing to be putting out this music. It to then to have the big bosses go, nah, shit, it's not gonna connect. It's not this, that and the other. It's not for us.
We had to wait. It wasn't until a year later. So we released Insomnia and Salvemeyer twice. In the early days, before they really connected, because there was no platform. Platform, I keep saying that word, but you have to think about where your music lives. And I teach on a master's course where I've got my studio, which I'm really enjoying. And again, a lot of people make music, but they don't think about where does it live? Does it live in DJs' boxes? Does it live in a club environment? Is it just for headphones only? Is it just for streaming platforms? Mm. Does it live in a multimedia setup, you know? Does it live on gaming? Is it soundtrack music? So, you know, we didn't really have a platform for our music beyond the clubs until Radio 1 changed its setup, and also MTV became more and more powerful, and we had a video that connected and the song connected in Europe. And it was Pete Tong who pressed us to re-release it. He said, I'm telling you, this record's getting bigger and bigger. And as a DJ, I also had this vibe where I kept Insomnia in my record box for a year after the first release and could just watch people going madder and madder and sort of requesting it. So I knew it was starting to connect. So cool. You know, thank you, Pete, for saying, look, guys, you really should put this record out again. There's something about it. And he was right. And by then it had gathered this international kind of wave. You get this feeling when you're having a hit record, you probably felt it yourself, where there's a synergy. Everything feels, you know, everywhere you turn, you can hear your tune. It's kind of mad and discombobulating, but you kind of know it's working. So we had this wave of support in Europe. The record was a hit over there before it was in the UK.
And then the album took off, right?
Yeah, and a video. So there was a visual representation of who and what Faithless were, because dance music artists are quite faceless. A lot of people don't know what you look like.
Massively so.
So we had all these things happening at the same time. It kind of, well, over a year, it coalesced into us re-releasing the record, having a top three hit, and it opening the doors for us to tour the world and people knowing about our album. So these records, Insomnia and Salva Mayor, were the only dance tracks on our first album, Reverence. Everything else was quite kind of groovy or almost ambient or quite chilled out. So it was something we were always trying to slightly battle with, is, gosh, we're a dance band that, you know, we're a live band that does dance music. Yet a lot of the music isn't that dancey. It's quite chilled out. And then a lot of people only know us for Insomnia or Salva Mayor. And so there was a lot of work to be done to kind of convey what Faithless was in a coherent way. And that really did come through the live shows. And that's how we ended up, you know, I guess having the space to do a second album and carry on, because people discovered the first album through the big singles, but also through the live show.
Whenever I think of Faithless, I think of the live show. And I know that that was quite an intrinsic thing into you guys as a force, that it wasn't you, the live show that was created was such a thing that wasn't really done with dance music, especially, you know, especially in that sort of thing. You had the Chemical Brothers, who would do a big live show with lights and stuff, but you guys really showed. Faithless was all about the instrumentation on stage, right? And that connectivity and bringing a live performance. Yep.
And a mix of electronic and acoustic instruments. I mean, that was what was really exciting for us. Like, Maxi was very determined right at the beginning, because I don't want to do a PA. He'd done PAs before, DAT tape and a microphone. It wasn't enough. And we were like, yeah, fine, brilliant. So we cobbled together a band of basically all the stoners that we were all hanging out with and working with in various different projects, and did our first live gig, and then was requested to play all over Europe as the record went up the chart. So it was really mad. We were playing really big venues in Europe, and we'd only done a couple of gigs at the Jazz Cafe that hold 400 people.
These were live shows, were they?
It was, yeah. And so this was a real baptism of fire. But, you know, I think that is the thing that made us really versatile. Like I said earlier, we could stand up there with a rock band because we looked like a rock band. We got a guitar, we got bass, we got percussion, we got live drums, but they were also melded with electronic elements, which were, you know, some of the parts, some of the samples off the album, and lots of synthesizers courtesy of me noodling away in the corner. And also live vocals. So it's got this immediacy. It's trying to recreate the textures of the album, but our live shows were quite distinct from our records because they weren't just like a carbon copy. You know, sometimes you go and see a band and they're just doing it note for note, just like the record.
You might
as well just be listening to the record loud. And ours was a much more visceral experience because our records were very dense and quite textured, and you just can't fit that all in. The human ear just can't take that in like an hour and a half. So it's like we broke down the music and almost remixed it for the world of live. And for whatever reason, that's kind of really the bones of what we do.
Well, it's a big flag plant in the ground, because I definitely try, and I've always tried to do that in my career. I've always tried to create a different experience live than you would listening to it in your bedroom. That's so innovative, you know, because a lot of people would think you go into a show to see somebody to hear what you've bought into, when really you're bringing a whole different experience. And then people could go back and listen to that same album they've just seen live and have a completely different relationship with it, coming back to it.
But sometimes it would confuse people if the bit that they wanted to sing along then came in a different place in the song, so we elongated a section or reduced it. They'd be like, where's the bit where I come in?
Yeah.
But I think you get the feeling that there's actually different ways to interpret your music that could be really effective. Like, there were certain tricksy things you could do on record that just wouldn't translate live. You'd lose the audience, you'd lose momentum.
Right.
They just wouldn't get it, even if they knew the records inside out. So as we went along, that's how we kind of ended up programming our live set, if you like, to be a different beast from the record, a kind of standalone experience.
I really wanted to ask you about your DJing, because obviously I met you I can't remember what festival we were at, but I was with Pete Tong.
That was lovely, wasn't it? Southampton.
It was a beautiful day, and I was doing Pete Tong Heritage Orchestra Ibiza Classics. And the reason why I wanted to choose a kind of a really off the wall track of yours for you to go, oh, she's chosen that. But the reason why I chose Insomnia was because I was sat a few cabins down from you. And I was, I'm not the quietest person at the best of times, but I was lying on some sort of beanbag going, do, 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 do. And you came out of your dressing room and I was like, who is singing my song terribly badly? And then that's how me and you got chatting, right? Because then you knew my boyfriend and so on and so forth. So I am going to introduce this next track before we start talking about DJing, because I really want to find out about this. But this is the reason why we met, and this is such a beautiful song that I get to see live with Pete Tong, doing the touring.
Pete
with
working
him.
His magic again. I think we've all been blessed by the wand of Pete over the years.
We have. I definitely fucking have. So let me quickly introduce this. This is Faithless Insomnia, and this is my track for as to why you're one of my guests. Sleep. So let's play that.
Creaky noises make my skin creep. I need to get some sleep. I can't get no sleep.
Just a year younger than me, which makes me feel, I don't know how that makes me feel.
Well, think how it makes me feel. God.
The reason why I started this whole podcast in the first place was because I felt like I was missing out on some sort of golden age of rave. And with tracks like that, I definitely feel like I did. That song has transcended every trend. There's nothing dated about it. You could still release that now. It could be a completely unheard track and it still goes off. I mean, the Pete Tong Ibiza Classic show was just, that is the part of the set where people just lose their shit. And you've got, what I love about that whole tour is because I get to experience a sense of nostalgia that I never lived through, but I get to share that with other people. And that's why I was felt so blessed to be a part of that. And I met Maxi last year because he was doing it live with us. And it's incredible how that has kind of changed my life as a 26-year-old and has changed so many other people's lives and has gone down generation to generation and probably will continue to as well. I do want to kind of ask, did you feel like you were making that track, that kind of iconicness at the time? Or did you just think, yeah, I'm sure people are like this? Or how did you feel?
Well, it was conceived as an answer track, if you like, to Sal Vermeer. So the first album, Reverence, we conceived like a proper vinyl record with an A-side and a B-side. And we only had one out-and-out dance track, which was Sal Vermeer, which is quite uncompromising, if you like, and quite introverted almost as a piece of music.
It's great,
and especially lyrically. And Insomnia was like a more accessible version, if you like. And it was very quick. I came up with the riff and a bass line. And Rollo's like, put some strings on it. And then we crafted it. I was DJing loads at the time. I was like, right, we're doing a track called Insomnia. And Rollo rang Maxi up and said, right, we're doing a track called Insomnia because Blissey can't get no sleep. And he literally wrote the lyrics and came down the next day and recorded them. So it came together very quickly. There was absolutely, which is what I love about the early days of recording. It's naive. It was, you know, really no idea it would connect in the way that it did.
Wow.
You know, as I said, we were told to go away by radio when we first started trying to plug it We knew that it was working a bit with dance music DJs and that it had a bit of a fan amongst the kind of club base, but we, you know, we never knew it was going to be a crossover hit. And it wasn't written, if you like, intentionally. As I say, it was 8 minutes long. It wasn't a 3 minute hit single with a big poppy chorus at all. It was a bit of a game of two halves. It's very brooding and long, kind of stringy. And then you get that drop and then the kind of release at the end. But it took a long time. It was percolating, as I say, for over a year before it got re-released and really recognised in that top 40 way. Well, it became top three kind of way, which was
so fucking cool.
You know, utterly, the whole thing was a sponge. What most people don't know is how chaotic we were as well. We didn't have any management until our fifth album and we kind of muddled through on our own. And all I can say, it was miraculous, but also that the record companies that we were signed to outside of the UK were all bigger and more heavyweight than our label in the UK. That was actually Half Rollo's record label called Cheeky Records. But there's a lot out there on the internet if anybody's interested.
Did you enjoy that time independent releasing?
It was a struggle, but I guess maybe some of the best things in life are born of a bit of struggle.
How does it compare to being in a major label? Because I've done both and I would have to say that it was harder doing it independent, but I would say I had a lot more fun and control over what I did and when I did it. Was it a similar experience for you?
In a way, yes. So the independent label Cheeky was co-owned by a guy called Mel Medalli. He'd had big hits with Robin S, Show Me Love, and also Salt and Pepper, Push It. And he had no money coming in from any other source. He really was one of the last truly independent record labels in London. And an extraordinary character. Again, I wouldn't be talking to you now if it wasn't for Mel. He agreed to do a label deal with Rollo, and that's how we put Faithless out on Cheeky Records, which was half his and half Rollo's.
Nice.
So in a way, we didn't have those negotiations and that you go through with massive record companies. It has to go through 50 people. There were four people working in a little house in Harlesden, and that was the record label.
There's a beauty in that, right?
There was, but the difficulty also was in terms of budget. Like, we didn't have tour support or anything like that. So, and also making big videos. All the other electronic artists in our ilk, sort of Underworld, Chemical Brothers, all had major record label deals at this time. And we didn't sign one until the third album, where it became clear that we did need that kind of structure. But there was a great immediacy to it. And Mel used to come down and anything we did, he'd go, Rollo and Bliss, because he's Irish. Because it's the best thing you've ever done. It's the best thing you've ever done. Which is very gratifying, you know. A lot of A&R people are playing a big game and it's all about their own careers and climbing the greasy pole and you're involved in other politics.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very simple. There was the head of the label, Mel, and Rollo, who was also head of the label and also part of the band.
Yeah.
So there was a different set of relationships, if you like, which led to, in some ways, less friction and later on, possibly more friction.
Right. Double-edged sword.
Yeah, we were a ramshackle operation from the off, but Mel knew how to put away a record, you know? So he had great sort of skill and savvy in that department. There's no question.
What a nurturing environment as well to be in that sort of...
He left us to it, really. Sort of wasn't... In a way, it was nurturing. That's literally all he'd say. It was great or it was shit.
There wasn't much in between.
But he just let us get on with it. There was an enormous amount of trust and also our experience being signed to a label because we'd had success on our own terms. Again, there was a lot of trust there. We were pretty much left alone and we could call on the label for the things we needed, like list of video directors, great artists, animators, you know, those sort of things. But do you know what? You can do all of that yourself. So we did that when we released to All New Arrivals. We set up our own record label and put our own music out and we self-funded it because by then we had the fan base to be able to do that and we brought in consultants, you know, to do international, to do marketing, to do promotion.
So fucking smart, man.
It's a calculated risk, put it that way. Like everything in life, there's positives and negatives from all sides.
Right. There's a couple of questions and I want to ask, but I don't know in what order to ask it. I want to talk about... Thomas Dolby and Wind Power, which I listened to yesterday and absolutely fucking loved and still sounds
super
fresh. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Had you even heard of him before this?
I think I'd heard of him. I don't think it was around the synth. I love 80s synth pop myself. And you know, I kind of try and draw a lot from that. So why is this track significant to you?
Well, it was when I got my very first Walkman. So this is your own personal technology that you can listen to music through. You don't have to listen to what your parents are listening to. You don't have to sort of haggle over the record player. I could put headphones on and listen to my own music. And I had this on cassette. I probably taped it off the radio. And I could not stop listening to it. The way the synthesizers reverberated in my head. It was like the first time I'd lived inside stereo. I was utterly immersed in it. He was a bit like a kind of English eccentric version of Kraftwerk, and these sounds just sounded like they were from the future, but they were also, there was a lot of musical collage, like he put the shipping news on the end of the track, you know, kind of almost surreal. So he's putting together things that maybe shouldn't be on a record. I mean, Kate Bush did that, and I'm a massive fan of Kate Bush, but I thought I'd choose this because he, for me, felt so electronic and experimental. And I guess that must have influenced me subconsciously and consciously, that I was drawn to the keyboards, what you could do with layering them up, and that one man could almost be an orchestra. So he had a very early synth called a PBG, and he actually called it Henry, and it was as big as a massive fridge freezer. Imagine, you know, carting that about on gigs. He personalised his technology, and that's another thing for me, that technology, people feel, oh, it's got no soul. You can't have soul in electronic music. But for whatever reason, the music of Thomas Dolby and that first album, the Golden Age of Wireless, it really spoke to me. And it was a very British kind of sound as well, somehow.
So without further ado, this is Thomas Dolby and Wind Power. Please enjoy like I did. Let me ask you a question that I don't really want to ask you, because I'm sure there's not many women in music is what I'm trying to say, is trying to ask. Have you felt like you've stuck out?
I think it's been an advantage as well as a disadvantage. I think, like pretty much every profession, there isn't parity in terms of pay. I think the lack of women has meant that some women get more visibility more quickly, perhaps in a world that's very male dominated, but mm-hmm. There's a lot of expectation that perhaps a woman won't be as good as a guy in a similar situation. And I think that starts in school. It's from, you know, that bias towards technology, technological, scientific subjects being somehow gendered as male subjects. And the more women you see in our world and doing things that require technical ability, I guess the more encouraging that is for other people. It always helps when you recognise someone who's a bit like yourself and you think, oh, well, I can do that. If she can do it, I can do it.
Do you feel like the groupie culture with DJs backstage, I've definitely seen my share of girls who are there to suck the DJ's dick.
No, nobody sucked my dick. It's been very annoying.
Isn't it irritating? Because yeah. Men get it all. Nobody's after... Do you know what I'm... We don't get the same... Because I think men don't really... They feel inferior to women in a position of power. Have you had much experience with that? Has anybody, you know...
No, I'm a bit of an ice maiden. No, I'm not. I'm very friendly, but I've just never been harassed in that way. I'm absolutely blessed to say I've been treated with, I'd say, pretty much 99.9% respect. But also, I work for good people. I feel I've been lucky. The gigs I've done, the promoters I've worked with, I've had long relationships, you know, spanning 25 years in this industry. And I really can count on the fingers of one hand unpleasant experiences. But also maybe... Performing as a DJ is a different beast. Perhaps you're less vulnerable in some way because you're behind decks, or I don't know. Also, I had a pretty hard aura. I think people found me a little scary, maybe.
Well,
I mean, I don't think I am.
Put it like this. I wouldn't fuck with you, but I wouldn't be scared of you. I'd want you on my team, but I wouldn't.
You can be on my team, Becky. I would be glad to have you on mine as well. But giving it feisty women power.
Did you feel like you had to be like that?
I think when you're in a very male dominated environment, you need to be a little bit tough, you know.
Yeah.
And then I'm in a band environment, which there were women in the band as well. I think that's what was amazing about Faithless. It was a multicultural, multi-gender band, which is what I loved about it. It was representative of the world that I live in.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real spirit. To be a musician, it's not an easy life, and I think it does require a certain toughness. It's very difficult because I think a lot of musicians are very vulnerable and open. They have a very sensitive soul, and that could be very easily damaged, or maybe sometimes very damaged people are drawn to the arts. It's the place where they can express themselves. But I wouldn't
very
say it's a very
point.
Safe environment. You have to have a bit of resilience and robustness. You know, the travelling, the hours, the lack of sleep, that itself takes a massive toll on mental health. And then throw in sexism or racism on top of that. It's a tough one. I'm not saying any of it should be tolerated. I'm saying that I didn't feel like I gave people an opportunity. I felt I worked very, very hard to be the very, very best. I was extremely ambitious, and I felt I wanted to be the best DJ in the world, which is probably ridiculous. But I knew that to be taken seriously as a woman DJ, not like, oh, she's up there because she looks pretty.
Right.
That I had to work hard. And then people go, oh, she can really mix. Oh,
yeah.
She can really rock it. She really understands the music.
Which
she
wouldn't
I'm a music nerd. Though. I know this music inside out and back to front as much as any male DJ. But that kind of felt like, you know, it's part of the package. Or at that time in the 90s. And there were certainly other female DJs who were really supportive towards me, who I owe a lot to. People like Smoking Joe, Rachel Auburn. They were really, really supportive. And they were my heroes as well, because there were very few female DJs around. People like Lisa Loud, Nancy Noyes, they were trailblazers.
How cool.
And they were feisty and they had attitude and they knew what they were doing. You know, seriously, good people. So, and Princess Julia, can't forget the Queen of London nightlife. Princess Julia is an amazing person and still going.
Well, it's a shame because there isn't necessarily anybody out of my generation that's kind of filled those places. And I kind of want to help encourage people. I'm conscious I've got 4 minutes left with you, so I'm going to introduce can you tell me a little bit about your final track?
Yeah, my final track, it's got to be an all-time favorite for many, many reasons. Donna Summer, I Feel Love. The influence of this record and pretty much anything produced by Giorgio Moroder, it's hard to put into words, really. He's influenced modern dance music. The feeling of this record, it's sort of everything that dance music could be. Perfect, glacial, warm, human, machine, kind of all at the same time. And I feel I also owe that record a debt, because the way the strings move on Donna Summer's I Feel Love, I took that string motif for Insomnia. When Rollo said, wow, put some strings on the beginning, I'd made a record with an artist you might have heard of called Adamski. And we were discussing, why are the strings so spine-tingling on Donna Summer's I Feel Love? And it's because they move from a major chord to a minor chord.
Right.
And then they move back again. And it must have been inside me. When I was just playing those strings, that's what came out.
I feel like this track has influenced quite a lot of people and still does now. So let's get it on. This is Donna Summer, I Feel Love. Bliss, I feel like I could talk to you for an age, but I can't. So I appreciate you coming on so, so much. It is an absolute honour to have you talking to me.
It's been so lovely.
Such a fucking cool person. I love you so much. One thing I am going to end on.
Yes.
And this podcast has always been about how the culture and the scene of rave has changed over the years. Do you feel like you DJ to a new generation? How different do you think rave is now?
Wow, that's an amazing question. For me, the simple answer is people have been dancing to a repetitive beat since the beginning of time, since we were cavemen banging on a log. And I think that spirit is the same. I think at the minute it is going to move into the less regulated area of rave, a bit like the old days. We're in a period that clubs and festivals can't happen, people still seem to need that buzz and energy of gathering together. So I think in a lot of ways it hasn't changed at all. You need a sound system, you need some music, and you need a crowd. And that is the essence of raving, really, isn't it?
That is exactly what I wanted to hear.
Yeah,
so I haven't missed
anything.
Hasn't
changed.
Sister Bliss, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today. You are an absolute fountain of knowledge, and I am sure I will see you at a festival very soon.
Oh
next
God,
year
I hope
or
can't
at
wait
some
to
point.
Hang out backstage on a beanbag.
Yeah.
So yeah, thank you so much for having me, and check out New Faithless single out on July 17th.